Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of the show. Today, for me personally, is a super exciting episode. I'm joined by Fernando de la Cruz, who's Program Director of Game Design at Full Sail University. But labels aside, he is a longtime friend from way back in the day. Fernando, I can't call you Fernando, I have to call you Fern. Sorry, old habits die hard. Welcome to the show, man. How are you?
I'm absolutely wonderful to be here speaking with you. It's been a long time, and we've been friends forever. I can say this with confidence that you're one of the oldest friends that I still keep in touch with.
Wow.
Probably the oldest friend that I actually keep in touch with.
You don't mean by age though, man. I'm an actor. My ego gets out of whack if you're not kidding. I'm not one of those actors, trust me. I'm not one of those thespians.
I was a thespian.
Oh, I'm so sorry. You're recovered.
I know. Actually, my first year of undergrad, I went for theater performance. That's an actual thing.
I saw like a podcast you did a few months back, and I watched it last night. I can't remember the name of it now. Sorry. But you literally said that you sort of originally studied theater, and I was like,
yeah.
Oh, amazing. Interesting. Like, let's talk a little bit about that then, sort of nice little segue. How did you go from studying that world and sort of that side of stories to then moving into game design and sort of doing what you're doing now?
So if it's a while ago, but if you recall, I did theater when I was at ICS, and we were at ICS together.
Okay. I don't recall much going back that far.
I know it's a while ago, so that's where everything started. It started with my brother, who he did it first, and then I followed in his footsteps, and I started doing theater. And then when we moved to Argentina, and we were at a school down there, I continued doing theater. It was like one of my favorite things to do. When we moved from Argentina back to the States, I still did theater. I started going into musical theater, which I didn't really do a ton of in the other places. So, like, I was doing theater the entire way from about sixth grade all the way to my senior year of high school, and I was dead set on being an actor, like dead set.
What happened?
My first year of undergrad was great. Honestly, it really was.
Right.
I enjoyed it. I got cast as a freshman in a play in second semester. There's a tremendous number of positives that was really fulfilling, really exciting. But there was just something not right. I don't know what it was. Some of it I think was just college age actors not knowing how to support each other and be excellent to each other. It's an age where I think it's still really fun to be gossipy and just not supportive is the best way that I'll describe it.
It can be a stupidly competitive and catty thing anyway.
Yeah.
Regardless of age, but I guess especially at that age when you're going through a bunch of other stuff too, and then it's like, oh, that person just got that, or like, well, who do they, like, I'm better than them, who do they think they are? And you're all in your head about stuff that when you get a bit older you look back and go, that doesn't mean a damn thing. And like, yeah, I feel that. I hear you. It can be toxic if you're in the wrong circles.
So gaming was my other love. And, my parents weren't exactly thrilled because I'd been saying the actor line for years at this point. And so I was like, hey, I want to go make games instead. They actually took me to a couple of places. Just a couple of times they had me have some conversations with some psychologists just to make sure that, like, I was okay. Because I've been so consistent all my life, and then just like out of nowhere I was like, hey, I'm gonna go in this other direction. And
was it really that quick, like sort of almost from one day to the next?
Yeah, it really was. It was almost overnight. There's just like one day I was just like doing this other thing. And You know, I found a school. We went down there, and they started becoming support. Once they committed to the fact that I was moving in this other direction, then they were in. They were like all in. Like, all right, cool. If we're doing this, we're doing this. And so we found a school. I went to school, did that stuff, and that's pretty much how it happened. You know, I was born with a controller in my hand anyway, so it was a natural direction for me to go into after theater.
And how did you find, because that must be a very different learning experience, though, in terms of the kind of stuff you learned when you're doing theater, which is much more sort of soft skills and ethereal and has, I think, still a lot of value to it. And it helps you as a person in some ways. But I guess to move into that and pivot and do something like gaming and game design, which from the outside looking into me seems like a lot of coding and like math and wireframing. And if a memory serves me right, and I'm going way back, I don't think, like me, you were the biggest fan of math in school. So, what was that like as a shift?
It's interesting, right? Because you recall correctly that math and I didn't always get along, and I always explained that away by saying, I was like, I'm going to be an actor. Math isn't necessary for acting.
Right. So you just didn't try back in school, is what you're saying.
Exactly. So when I got to, you know, learning how to design video games and stuff, they're like, hey, you actually need math. And I was like, well, that sucks. You know, like, okay, I guess I should have paid attention all those years. So a lot of my classmates, you know, it came very easy and natural to them to, you know, tackle all of these mathematical concepts and apply them in the right ways. For me, it was a lot harder because I was just, you know, stunted to a degree. Like I was handicapped. So I had to work a little longer, work a little harder. You know, basically before I could actually apply a mathematical concept, I had to take a few steps back and like teach myself that mathematical concept, and then move on to into application. And I'm still slow at some of those things to this day. Like to this day, I always have to go look up, you know, just some refreshers on some mathematical concepts, in particular like physics. Like I have to use equations of motion all the time, and even though I've been using them for years, like I still have to go back and like watch a couple of refreshers on some equations of motion. Like, okay, how do I isolate this variable? Okay, so I know these are my knowns, these are my unknowns. How do I move this thing from over here? Okay, I have to do this all the time. Whereas a friend of mine can just be like, oh yeah, I know how to do this, and like they just jump into it. So it's a handicap, but it's not. It doesn't stop me from being effective. It just takes me a little bit longer
Sure.
to be effective. But I was almost like shell-shocked. It's just like how hard it was for me. You know, and going from all these soft skills into a world where you're using programming and math and all that stuff. And you know, it was a lot of programming. The degree that I got was called Game Design and Development, but it was all C++ programming. Like that was the foundation, and then they like layered on some design theory on top of it. So I went from C++ class to C++ class to C++ class. It was just programming until my face melted off.
Do you feel like that's the maybe big misconception to people that either A are sort of trying to get into it but don't really know enough about it, or B just like the regular gamer who plays but doesn't go deeper into the making of them? Do you think that the misconception normally is they don't quite understand how much like deep level root coding, hardcore coding goes into that stuff, or?
Yeah, I think there is a huge misconception about the difference between programmers and designers. I think that, and I did this myself, like when I was growing up, you know, and you know, one of the things that naturally took me towards design was I would write stories in my books, I would draw maps, I would write quests, all these things that are easy for me to wrap my head around, right? It's like if I'm interested in games and I want to make games, I gravitate towards the things that are easy for me to grasp. And those are things like narrative. You know, it's like the idea of there's this character and this thing happens to this character and he has to go save this person and you know go on this quest. Like those, I can understand that. I'm not good at it, but I can understand it. The stuff that I don't understand is programming, the logic underneath. And we've got these commercial engines now, like the Unity engine or the Unreal engine. And a bunch of others as well. that are so powerful. And these engines were built for a reason, and it was to enable designers to express themselves.
Sure. To me, as a layman, and if I'm wrong, correct me, that sounds a little bit like the WordPress equivalent for web design. Like, you mm-hmm. can go and do it and move widgets around, but actually, whilst you can buy a theme off the rack and it does something, you still probably need that underlying knowledge of how to do your, you know, style sheets and modify your HTML code to really make it the all singing, all dancing thing you want. Is that a fair analogy?
Yeah, it's close. Saying, it's close. You know, the engine comes with things like, you know, collision, so that your characters don't fall through the world, or the ability to just draw things to the screen, all right, or the ability to send a message from one object to another object, right? So it's all these things that, like, all games need. All games need these things. And then your game, the one that you have in your head, what is that really about? What can the player do? Okay, so if the player can run, if they can jump, if they can shoot a gun, if they can, you know, use a grappling hook, those are things that you'll likely have to do yourself, right? And so the knowledge, when I say, like, physics equations of motion, it's like, okay, well, I need to shoot a projectile through the air. How do I want that projectile to move through the air? Do I want it to be in an arc? Is this a realistic simulation? So if I'm shooting a sniper rifle, I have to aim above your head, considering that the bullet's going to fall a little bit. Or is it arcadey? In which case, I can just do a line trace from the muzzle to, you know, your head, and you know, have a little bit of you know, error based on your accuracy or whatever to, you know, make it, you know, fun, I suppose. But these are things that are all solved through programming, and it's stuff that you have to manually do in order to build the game that you have in your head. And the field of game design has turned into a field of prototyping. You know, it's like, okay, cool, you have this idea in your head, build it quickly, prototype it, put it in people's hands, and see what people think. You know, are we moving in the right direction? Are we moving in the wrong direction? Do we toss the entire thing out? Can we fix a couple of things and then test again? It's that, you know, get in, roll your sleeves up, build it, and see if we're going in the right direction or not. And if you look at entry-level positions for designers, like, that's what they're looking for, is people mm-hmm. who can quickly come in and prototype experiences.
And so with that, the key thing is someone who has that coding experience beyond just, like, I guess there's not two sides to it. It's not one person will come in and just be the very, you know, overarching storyteller, and then a separate team that does the hardcore coding. You literally need the combo within that person.
Yeah, so there is a position called narrative design, right? And so then your narrative designers are not going to be people that understand programming. They're not going to be people, not typically, right? It's pretty rare for them to understand that stuff. I mean, sometimes you find a unicorn and they can do everything, but your narrative designers are people that have actually studied how to create narrative experiences, right? Mm-hmm. Similar to if you want to be a playwright or something along those lines, like, you don't just fall into that. I mean, I suppose there's the rare unicorn that does, but the majority of folks that, you know, they want to become a playwright or a screenwriter, they have to study how to write, right? And so they need to study the structure, you know, the hero's journey and all the other kind of narrative paradigms in order to construct realistic and effective and coherent narrative experiences.
So I'm totally with that, and it makes complete sense, because obviously they're mediums that do have these nice overlap. Mm-hmm. My natural thought that just light bulb came into my mind around that would be, what about these open world kind of games that we now have on our sort of doorstep, where I suppose that narrative journey can't be quite as linear, because in theory, it's never ending. You take something like Warcraft as an example, or League of Legends. There are those story and gamified elements, obviously, in them to keep people coming back. Mm-hmm. But how does that sort of linear, traditional, from a, say, movie perspective, story work within those worlds? Or is it sort of a different amalgamation of that?
So it depends on, like, which type of open world we're talking about, right? Because
gotcha.
World of Warcraft is MMO, right? So that's massively multiplayer online.
Yeah.
And then you have open world, which is, a little bit more similar to like a modern example would be Ghosts of Tsushima. Ghosts of Tsushima is a fantastic little open world game. And so the way that they're going to approach things is going to be a little bit different. So let's take a look at a game like World of Warcraft. When you just start out, like when you first create your character, the way that they approach things is actually pretty similar. Which is that you have a limited space that you can play in. You can't necessarily go anywhere, right? You have a starting location, and you don't even see everything in your location. You have a very, very tiny little space. You have a very simple quest of go talk to that person that's directly in your view, right? And when you do, he's going to give you a quest that's like 6 steps over there. Go, I don't know, beat up a squirrel, and then like you go do that, and then you come back, right? And so, they use these quests to help guide where the story's going, and they limit the space, even though it's open world. Like you could, if you really wanted to, the second your character's created, if you try really hard, you could go to a different starting location if you really, really wanted. It's hard because you have no mounts, you have no ability to fast travel. Like you have to like manually walk from one starting location across the entire continent to another starting location, and that takes forever. And you can die at any point. And if you die at any point, you respawn back in your starting location. Right, so it is an excruciating process if you want to circumvent this, and that's intentional. In Ghost of Tsushima. You don't necessarily have that same ability to kind of go anywhere you want to because the quests won't be there. Right? In World
Gotcha.
of Warcraft, if you land in another starting location, yeah, you can go talk to somebody over there and start doing some of your starter quests in that other location. But even though Ghost of Tsushima is open world and you can tackle the things in the order you want to, they're using the quests in order to guide what's actually available for you to do. And so you can go off on your own and go somewhere else, but you're just going to be doing random things with no direction. Maybe there's one or two quests that pop up, but generally speaking, all the story related quests and most of the side quests are going to be in the area that you were already in before.
It's interesting because
And
it ties into the same thing as screenwriting, where there is an underlying logic that needs to be applied. And I don't know, it kind of feels like it's with that, it's almost passing that back to the gamer to let their innate sort of storytelling part of themselves that they don't even know about, maybe in a tangible way, sort of lead them organically. You almost, to your point, could go and roam the world and then probably die a zillion times and just get really pissed off. But I suppose the way it's set up with the logic lets you then sort of tap into your own inner storyteller and go, well, these are the next sort of steps I should take in my hero's journey whilst playing this game.
Exactly.
So do you feel like, on an ethereal kind of level, do you feel like everybody innately does have that sort of inner storytelling blueprint inside of them, even if it's subconsciously,
I don't know about, I suppose to some degree, I think we do because we're so attra as humans, we're so attracted to stories in general. And we've been listening to stories all our lives. Whether it's through any mediums, right? Whether it's books, plays, musicals, movies, games, even music. Like we've been listening to stories all our lives. So it makes sense that when you are consuming that structure over and over and over and over again, and even like at the high school level, you have at least some awareness of structure, right? Because you study at the shallowest level, you study things like hero's journey and just some of the stuff that's like probably somewhat easy to kind of wrap your head around. Poetry and you study these things in school growing up. So you have at least some innate sense of structure through everything that you have consumed and also through just some very kind of shallow introductions to structure through your schooling years. And I think that's, you know, whether, regardless, I mean, how many people have you met is like, oh, I've got an idea for a movie, you should do this. Or like, hey, I've got an idea for a game, you know, why don't you do this? Like, everybody has ideas for a story, right? They don't know how to structure it, but they have that idea. They have this motivation to want to express themselves through some kind of a story. They just don't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what separates out the people who actually go into it and become successful and the people who just want, like, there's this sure. wanting of going in that direction, but they'll
same
never
as
actually...
anything, right? It's the execution is where obviously the less glamorous side of it is. And I guess, you know, that's where you really realize if you want it, as in genuinely want to live a life, going into the dirt and executing something that's not glamorous probably every day or many days. I guess for people who, you know, are in it or are getting into it, and I guess with a lot of the stuff that you do at Full Sail, have you seen any sort of shift over the years in terms of maybe the type of person or personality type of people coming in? Or do you feel like normally it sort of tends to lend itself towards a certain type of person or individual? And that seems very broad brushstroke, but I don't know if there is any answer to that.
So the game design bachelor's degree program is the single largest degree program at Full Sail. And so we pull in everybody under the sun.
Gotcha.
I mean, I see the full spectrum of the people that 100% get it, right? And like just through even very early conversations, you can tell that they're in the right place. To people who are more attractive to like narrative design, but don't understand how to like separate the two things. Right. And some of those folks through instruction will eventually get it, but it's clear that when they come in, they don't. And so we do a lot of things to educate them before they enroll. We have like behind the scenes tours and things of that nature. The second they enroll, like we have meet and greets with your program director, stuff like that. And so we try to tell them all the time, like, hey, this is what you're about to get into. You still want to do this? So we try to do these things to kind of prep them so that the people on that other end of the spectrum can understand, like, just so you know, if you think that it's about this, it's actually about this other thing. Mm-hmm. So I see a full spectrum. I probably see it skewed towards the direction of people that don't understand what they're getting themselves into, which I think makes a lot of sense.
It sounds similar to sort of people who go to film school and learn how to be filmmakers, and you get this broad range of people who are, you know, general movie enthusiasts to that seems like something that's more fun to study than going and like studying, you know, accounting to yeah. then like, you know, the people that have been picking up a camera from the age of like 5 and they're literally like Rodriguez trying to sort of figure out how to make their own film DIY style. Mm-hmm. I guess the slight difference might be, you know, for them, well, maybe I'm wrong because I don't know enough about it. For them, they all have like that end of year project. There's like that sort of golden goose at the end of the 3 years. At the end of your program, you'll make your final year film. That's your calling card to go into the world. And they feel like they're going to create their first movie. Does that happen with like the kind of stuff that you guys do? Do people literally get that sort of final year project calling card, or is it they do? Okay.
Yeah, they do. We have a capstone process that's 4 months long.
Right.
And you know, we put ourselves in teams of about 4 to 6 people. All of them are designers. So we don't have any programmers or artists on the team. So it's a bunch of designers, and you have to kind of like make do with what you got. You're using one of the engines, so either the Unity engine or the Unreal engine, to prototype some experiences. So you know you design an experience, and then you start building it and iterating on the prototype that you've built to get closer and closer to something that is coherent. And what we see in the capstone process is, you know, most projects fall into two buckets, right? Either the ideal happens, which is you have a group of students where they really understood the value of programming and how that can really facilitate them being an expressive designer. And they build some really cool prototypes that are polished, you know, flawed in terms of design, but executed very well. And, you know, it's clear that these people understood the value of the education and how to apply it. And then there's the other bucket of the people that were scared of programming, remained scared of programming, and, you know, kind of never faced that fear. And when you get to Capstone and you're in a group of people and, you know, there's nobody on the team, maybe one person on the team that has any kind of confidence programming, it really limits what you're able to accomplish. And, you know, you see a pretty strong divide between the types of projects that actually come out of Capstone between the folks that are confident in programming and it really lets them express themselves freely, and the folks that don't, where they have to go to much simpler experiences because that's what they're capable of expressing. Sure.
And I guess you're also looking at how they work collaboratively as a team and take on different facets of whatever that project is. Because ultimately, like anything, you know, artistically, these things are big collaborations. It's not,
absolutely,
you know, one person doesn't get all, well, actually, that's not true. A lot of times one person does get a lot of the acclaim, but to be fair, behind it, like there's a whole swarm of people that are making this thing happen. So for you, how did you go from, I mean, I know you still work on like making some of your own stuff, but how did you fall into pretty much being full-time like
educator?
Yeah. Educator. And, you know, again, I go back to remembering you when we were so much younger and I'm thinking he was such a rebel. Like how did he turn into being the person who's now allowed to educate people? But, you know, like what, was that a natural transition or do you just feel like,
The older I get, the more introverted I get.
Really?
Yeah, dude, I'm such a hermit. you know, I think I was pretty extroverted when I was younger. I think it's probably pretty safe for me to describe myself as extroverted when I was younger.
Yeah, man. I remember the time when you like came over to my place in fifth grade and we literally like conned everybody to say that you were allowed to come and your mom knew and everyone knew and your mom had no idea.
Yeah, I was running away. I ran away to your house.
You were running away to my house for about 6 hours and then we thought it was the best ruse and then we got slammed hard.
Yeah, that was, you know, I thought that was pure genius, man, but they caught on to us quick.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if that was today with cell phones and everything, it would have lasted about a whole 5 minutes.
So yeah, I would say that I just got introverted. I got introverted as I got older, and you know, working in games is also you know, it was really fun to work on games. Like I shipped 15 games over 6 years, and it really kind of builds something in you because you know I spent so many hours in. You know, I'd do it all again. It was a blast. I loved the company that I worked at, but it was a lot of work. It was a lot of hours. You know, at times, you know, it could get up to 80 hours, 100 hours a week, which are hours that I'm sure that you can relate to when things get rough, and things need to get done. I'm sure that, you know, in film and stuff like that, that, you know, you do get some weeks that can get pretty brutal.
Yeah, we all can with any walk of life, but I think the thing is sometimes that's sort of in small blasts. Mm-hmm. Like with a film, it might be, you know, you have like a few weeks or like it's a month or two of a shoot.
Yeah,
that's then you can go away and sort of recover and recuperate. But with a game, I guess it's a long development process sometimes, and the closer you get to deadline or deadlines, you're maybe living that in loop and in perpetuity. That ain't good for just life balance.
Yeah, it would go in ebbs and flows, right? So there'd be weeks where you'd work 40 to 50 hours a week, and like you'd kind of like find like a, you know, a pretty consistent pace. But yeah, our milestones were 3 to 5 weeks long, and the closer you'd get to a milestone, your hours would climb up a bit. You know, so it didn't always get up that high, but it definitely got up. Definitely got up there. Sure. You know, when you're working that much, it's not like you're going out, right? I wasn't going out to the bars. So I just kind of naturally just go home and chill. I'll just go home and decompress. And I think that started like a me on the path of just becoming more introverted and just like wanting to just go back to my hidey hole, my safe place. And then my family's down here in Orlando. So when I had the opportunity to come down here, I was like, well, I can go closer to my family. There are times when this job can kind of get up there in terms of hours, but it's not the same as it was in the industry. And so I've been able to find a little bit better of a balance between work and life, which, you know, my wife and my kid both
appreciate. And I think you kind of, you know, have the best of both that way, where there's a little bit of balance and you're still involved with what you're passionate about and what you love. Out of interest, I'd be super keen to get your thoughts on like how you see things moving forward for the industry generally. And again, I'm sure there must have been shifts around the kind of stuff you've put in your syllabus as the past few years have evolved. I'm naturally gravitating towards the whole concept of esports, which isn't that new. It's not really, but I think
it's newer to us than it is to other countries.
Sure. Yeah, like in South Korea or somewhere like that, it's been around for ages. But I think to even the layman on the street, if you told them they had world tournaments for like, you know, these games that sell out the Nokia Theater or wherever,
yeah,
like 20, 30, 40,000 people watching two teams play games, certain generations would probably think that you're out of your mind. But the money in that industry is insane.
Yeah.
And it's like this thing where if you 10 years ago were playing games and said you were going to get into just being like on a team playing games for a living, your parents would probably slap you across the face a few times and said, you're out of your mind. Now, but now, like, it's
if only I'd known. If only I'd known.
Born in a wrong era. That's all it is. It's born in the wrong era. But that's it. Like, how many people do you feel now are not just coming to this from the perspective of, I want to make the games? Do you think there's a new breed of people, I guess, for lack of a term, coming in and saying, it's like, you know, saying, I want to play for Real Madrid. Like, I want to play. Well, I want these teams to have esports teams now. Like, I want to be the Manchester City FIFA 21 like team member. I want to be the League of Legends, you know, team member that travels the world. And is this like a new, I mean, it's a sport, really. I mean,
it's a sport. It's a sport. Yeah. I mean, these are athletes, right? And these are athletes and they are managed like athletes. They have to watch their nutrition. They have to watch their rest. They have to watch, you know, the health of their bodies because they're in these chairs for so long. And, you know, it's an area that I think we're still learning a lot about from a medical perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, there's fatigue, there's psychological impacts, there's physical impacts. You know, these are things that the medical community is still learning about. It is a new type of athlete, and it's like weird, I think, for a lot of people to come to grips with calling these individuals athletes. And it's something that I think that we're going to have to get over pretty quickly, because I think that, you know, esports is here to stay. And to give you an idea of just how much Full Sail in particular understands that esports are here to stay, we built an esports arena on campus. You know, I want to say, I'm not 100% certain here, I want to say it's the largest collegiate esports arena in the country, at least. You know, but it's an impressive space that is dedicated to hosting esports tournaments and having crowds there. And we host other types of events in there as well. But it's something that we understand is only getting bigger. We've had folks from Riot that work on the esports side come and give talks to students and things of that nature. And, I think esports is only going to get bigger. Obviously, like you talked about, you know, all these sports teams that are dipping in there and especially when it comes to FIFA. I don't know about the other sports, how much they're getting into it, but I know even MLS, they're doing the same thing. Orlando City has a FIFA player. All the MLS teams have a FIFA player. And, On the topic of football, while we're on it, remind me, you're either a Chelsea or a Leeds fan.
Say the second one, man. Don't be saying Chelsea to me, man.
Leeds,
Don't be saying
Leeds. You're a
Chelsea. I
Leeds
mean,
fan, right?
I yeah, Leeds, and I still kind of have a soft spot for Real Madrid, obviously growing up there
Yeah.
and watching them. But finally, I can say that I can support Leeds in public now that they've gone back to the Premier League and have like a decent, well, not even a decent. They have a manager who knows what he's doing and has culturally revolutionized the entire
Oh man, that first match
place.
was insane. The match against Liverpool, that match was insane.
Should have drawn, but whatever.
Yeah.
Mistakes happen. But yeah, Leeds not quite as intense as I was maybe back in high school, to be fair. Where like I'd watch a game and if they lost, I would probably be depressed for like a weekend and not talk to anybody. Whereas now I'm a bit more mature about it. But yes, Leeds, don't say Chelsea to me, dude. Come on.
My bad.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But it's interesting, the whole, what makes an athlete thing. As you were talking there, I was kind of thinking about that. And I guess we've always equated it to the physical side of whatever these people do. And I think that is a huge part of what makes an athlete, obviously. But I think a lot of times we admire athletes and the amazing ones like Cristiano, like Jordan, like Kobe, because of the mindset of the people. And I guess that's maybe the crossover and where we sort of look at the namings of talking about esports players as athletes. It's got to be the mindset of how these guys, like you said, focus on nutrition, training, managing their life, and I guess dedication. And perhaps to us as kids, it's like you get to play video games for a living. That's awesome. But maybe it's not as goddamn glamorous as it sounds when you're in a team living in a house with, six other teammates and you're doing it, whatever, 8 hours a day or whatever it is every day. That doesn't sound quite as glamorous when you put it that way.
When I'm enjoying a game, I can play it for like an hour, maybe 2 hours or something like that. Or like let's say everybody leaves the house and I'm by myself, right? And it's like, man, I'm gonna go crazy today. I'm gonna play this game for 6 hours. It's like, okay, cool, I can do that, right? But the difference is I get to leave whenever I want to. And number two, I get to play just to enjoy, right? So I'm not trying to refine particular strategies to such a degree that it consumes my life. I get to play. I get, if I want to pick a dumb strategy just to, fiddle around with something dumb, I can do that. If I want to take, if I want to play League of Legends and I want to take a character that normally goes top lane and I want to take him bottom lane just to piss off my entire team and, whatever, I can do that, right? Like I can do it just for the sake of doing whatever I want to and playing the game however I want to. It's if you're an athlete, like you are probably playing a very specific character or a subset of characters, right? Because you become experts at certain types of strategies or certain types of characters. You have to play that day in, day out, 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours, whatever it might be, in order to understand the nuances of that character at a
Crazy.
championship level. It is,
Crazy. It's like you're a striker or you're a center back or you're a goalie. It's the same thing but with gaming, and it's nuts. If you just it's going to be super fascinating to see how it evolves, especially on games like that. Sports games with esports teams, you can kind of it's a bit more clear cut, but something like League of Legends, it's this whole different kind of animal. And I know that as they play, people at League are then refining the way that the game operates based on how people are playing in each tournament. So it's not like,
Oh yeah.
you did one thing now and then it's going to work again the same next time, because they're then tweaking and changing everything. And it's always this ongoing fluid evolution.
So I play Runeterra, which is a competitive card, a digital competitive card game. And there's a professional streamer who consistently breaks the game, and then Riot has to go and like fix the thing that this streamer breaks, and it is pretty hilarious to watch. Like, they're basically playing whack-a-mole against this one professional streamer who finds like new ways to like just play degenerate combos and things of that nature. And you know, it is really, really interesting. And we didn't even talk about streaming as a part, as a kind of like a arm of esports. It's an incredible time to be a gamer. It's an incredible time to kind of be in this space. We have collegiate esports teams in like a dozen or so games. I would have loved, if I was a student, if I was a college student, I would have loved to have been a competitive player for my school and go on collegiate circuits and compete and stuff like that. It would have been amazing. So it's cool.
And time. Like you said, then with things like Twitch, you actually are like sort of, you know, the mainstream maybe doesn't see it quite as much, but the reach of those platforms are massive. And then, you know, I might hear about people, I'm like, who the hell is that? But they have like millions of fans all over the world. And, you know, it's this whole new thing where it's this new frontier, which isn't, it's not really Hollywood. It's not really like, you know, mainstream TV or press, but it's got its own, I don't want to say subculture because it's not a subculture, but it's just this huge behemoth that a lot of people don't know about, and it's going to keep growing. I saw, what would they do on Fortnite like a few months ago, that live gig that they did? Like,
oh yeah, they've done it a few times now where they do like a live concert or something along those lines in Fortnite, you know, broadcasting some kind of like televised event inside of Fortnite. I mean, that's, and they were like ridiculously successful with it. Like, it's absolutely bonkers. You know, I can't imagine being in the room saying, "Hey, let's put on a live concert inside of our video game," and everybody being like, "Yeah, that sounds like a good idea." I can't imagine it. Even 2 years ago, I never would have proposed such a thing. It's a really interesting, you know, kind of tweak that they've done. That they're open to a lot of different types of experiences inside of their space, and it's you know, it's fascinating to see.
Because that to me feels like there's just more opportunities for crossover now with the arts, where we'll have, I mean, I don't think, you know, traditional films and gigs and all these things will go anywhere, but there's this kind of new platform to reach more people. Like, if I'm a musician, yes, I can do a tour and gig in person, well, eventually, hopefully, but I'll still only reach X amount of people based on the number of tickets available to sell. If I can go on Fortnite or a platform like that, and someone will, I'm sure, figure out some weird thing we haven't thought about yet as to how that looks.
Yeah.
You could reach like however many people you want for, you know, maybe it's $5, which is more accessible to everybody, but it's this weird amalgamation of the world.
Yeah. And also, it'd be interesting because merchandising is another part of touring, right? Like, it's like they're looking to sell their merchandise, which is where they get a lot of their money when they're touring, stuff like that. But if you had, and I don't know enough about the live gigs in Fortnite, so I don't know what they do, but if you had like digital merchandise that you can bring into the game, like, I wonder if that's a way to kind of replace that, and then the bands get kickbacks off of the merchandise that's sold to kind of customize your character and stuff like that. Like, if you could do something along those lines, then like, yeah, I think that'd be totally viable.
I'm sure at some point. I mean, you know, it's the layman's version of it now is just like an affiliate link, right? But if you literally just are able to click on whatever and a pop-up appears, and then it'll be contextualized to you and your experience that you've had in the game normally. And now we're, you know, throwing advertising into the world of like gaming, but live arts at the same time. It's just, it's kind of, I don't think it's here yet, but something feels like it's on the cusp of happening with all of that. Yeah. Final few things. I was keen to get your thoughts on things like Bandersnatch, the Black Mirror episode. I don't know if you saw it, where they...
I haven't.
Game elements.
Which one was that? I've seen some of the Black Mirror stuff, but...
Bandersnatch was the one where you could actually pick your sort of journey of the protagonist. It was akin to like those books we used to read as kids, where it was like,
pick your own adventure stuff.
Yeah, do this and go to page 66 or go to page 32. It was that kind of pick your own adventure where they created a few different loops, and at different stages, you then got to pick what the next move was. And they
gotcha. Now, I don't think I've seen that one.
No.
You know, I will say that there are some efforts like that already. You know, just based off of what you've described, there are some like, you know, typically we think of games as like far more interactive experiences that have stories. There are some more movie-like interactive experiences on video game consoles that are much more passive and then give you some interactive moments to direct the, you know, the action that you're actually watching. And what they've done is they've done it in a kind of group setting where the group votes on what the characters do or where they go or things of that nature. And then based on majority rules, then, you know, that's the direction that the story will start to unfold. You know, so I don't, it may not be one-to-one 100% perfect for what you're describing, but there's at least people experimenting with things that are a little less interactive and a little bit more story and narrative driven, and then just give the audience moments to kind of interact and push the direction of the story. And then you can kind of like just play that multiple times and figure out like, okay, what did we miss? What if we pick a different option and see the characters go do something else? But I love those types of experiences, and games have always had these kinds of experiences. One of my favorite, which is an older game now, is the original Way of the Samurai. Mm-hmm. Way of the Samurai did this in a really interesting way in terms of storytelling, which is they had a real-time clock, or I say a real-time clock, based off of when you transition from one area to another area. Every time you transition from one area to another area, it would get later. And it was a small area that they had built, and events would only occur in these areas at certain times of the day. And so where you decided to go chose what events you got to see. And based off of the events that you saw, you would respond. However, like if you see somebody getting beat up, you can go in there and save them. But if you chose to go somewhere else and now you're coming over here, you see the aftermath of that person that has already been beat up. You know, it's things along those lines that, you know, they had multiple endings based off of your ability to join this team over here because you saw them, or join the other team over here because you saw them. You know, so it's like that style of storytelling is so fascinating to me and very attractive. And, you know, I'm excited to see where the industry goes, to see if we can get more of those kinds of experiences.
Yeah, stuff with a clear cause and effect that lets the user feel like it's their choice. But then I guess with that, to kind of bring this a bit full circle, comes the whole then additional parameters when it comes to the coding side of it, because the more you give people those permutations, the more blood and sweat and tears and all that craziness has to go into creating, well, thinking of the logic, creating the logic, and then like triple sense checking the logic actually works every single time. And that, you know, sounds like a long process just talking it out loud, but
yeah,
you know, I think like when you make a movie, people just see the end result. It's the same with a game. Nobody really looks at the fact that it takes, I mean, a movie can take, you know, 3 to 4 years from concept to like, you know, being finished. I guess with a game, it can be the
same. We're in similar territory. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Depending. So like if we're talking about AAA games, these AAA games can sometimes take 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And in some rare cases, longer. You know, so it's not unheard of for a game to take 6, 7 years to get put together. You know, and these are games, you know, similar to some of these blockbuster films that have, you know, a bajillion different hands working on it. Games are the same way. You have hundreds of people that end up touching the project. And these are like multiple studios in multiple countries that each have their own corner of the game that they're focusing on and stuff like that. So, which is, you know, in contrast to like your indie filmmaker, you know, your indie game maker, you know, so you have like The rare exceptions of like the 1 to 2 people, 1 to 5 people, those kinds of like small garage bands that are putting together some really interesting experiences and are able to kind of do that on their own, but they have to limit the scope of the experience in order for it to be accomplishable by such a smaller team.
But those things are equally as important, I guess. And would you say to people that are, I guess, just coming out of say a course like yours, there's many options beyond just trying to go and work right off the bat for one of these sort of huge companies? I mean, I'm sure that's an avenue, but do you feel that there's equal scope and even benefit to going a bit more indie and learning the ropes in a
Well,
grassroots way, or?
let me ask it to you this way. What percentage of indie filmmakers can only do indie filmmaking and have no other job?
No, I mean, yeah, exactly. It doesn't, you got to pay your bills, right? Obviously. So an indie film is not going to make a whole load of money per se.
Except for the ones that do, right? Like, so it's like you have the people that strike it hot. Right. And so I think that's what makes being an indie so romantic
Sure.
is that you see the successful indie hits and you'd be like, well, I'm going to go study filmmaking and I'm going to go be an indie filmmaker and I'm going to go strike it hot like this movie, right? Like cult classic right over here. That's what my movie's going to be. But then it's like, okay, yeah, that one struck it hot. These other 6,000 like didn't make a dime.
Yeah.
Right. And so like it's literally just like labors of love that get sent into the void and get consumed by like their parents. And like it's difficult. But you do it like you have to do it because you love it, and then you have to find where your income and your security is going to come from somewhere else. And down the line, maybe one of yours will eventually hit. Right, and go broad. Like that's the dream, right? And it's the same thing for games. It's I would have loved to, as soon as I graduated, go directly into indie game making. But marketing it is expensive. Building it is time consuming and expensive. I'm not an artist, so I would need an artist. I don't know how I'm gonna pay an artist. It's a difficult thing. It takes so many hands in order to make one of these and have it be a polished experience. And then getting the word out and getting people to try the thing that you have put together is excruciating. Like it's very difficult. Is it possible? Sure. Don't quit your day job. Like that's, if that's the direction that you want to go in, and it sucks to say that, but like, the first few years that I was at Full Sail, I was also working on some games on the side,
Right.
right? And so like Full Sail was my day job, while I continued to do my work.
But I think that's an important little conversation to have, though, because everybody looks at the utopia of whatever they think, whatever the industry is, whether it's gaming or filmmaking or whatever. And I think that there's a finite amount of opportunities to maybe get to that pinnacle. I think, it's a there is abundance for people, but you have to be realistic at where you are in your journey. What you know and how you can actually add value. And not everybody's going to jump to the, biggest studio in the world right off the gate. But then how do you still do your craft, not get bitter about it, and, pay your bills? Like nobody, the starving artist thing is not anything to aspire to. It's this really terrible trope, but like it's complete bullshit. And I think, I think it's an important thing that you're saying, that you work and also make games, and you can do both. And I think maybe back in the day it was kind of frowned upon, at least in the film and acting world. I don't know about gaming, but in the film and acting world, it was like if you told someone you did anything else but act, they thought you didn't take it seriously.
Yeah, but not the case in gaming. And I don't know if that's just kind of speaks to the different atmosphere in gaming circles versus acting circles. One of the things that attracted me to building games was just how supportive everybody is. everybody is extremely eager to share techniques, terminology, technology. You know, there's a conference every year, the Game Developers Conference, where professionals come from all over the world, and they will literally just share all their failures, share all their technology, share their techniques, because they're trying to build a better industry. And companies will pay for their employees to go share their secrets, right? And they do this because it almost becomes like a marketing tool to attract talent.
Sure.
Right? They see the value in sharing the stuff that they do. And the fact that this company pays for their employees to go speak at these events, you know, other people who do this are like, well, I want to go work at that company because that company, you know, number one, they use techniques that I am familiar with or that I like, or, you know, whatever it is, or maybe they work on games that I like or whatever it might be. But number two, if I get to do some cool stuff, I can come out here and I can do talks.
Yeah.
Right. I think there's a special thing about the game industry in particular that, you know, we want to help each other. We want to like a rising tide lifts all boats, that type of mentality. And I know there's a lot of that in circles in the theater and film industry. I think that there's this other kind of like layer that, you know, I don't know it as well as you do, but that is my perception.
No, I think it's catching up now. And I think it's sort of also the fact that the industry's been around a lot longer, and there's, again, like longer standing underlying ways of operating that maybe worked in past eras. And there's sort of knock-on effects of that where, you know, people have been made to feel like it's a competition and it's all cutthroat, and, you know, I'm competing with person A, B, and C for a role, or, you know, it's my movie or their movie, but it can't be both. And I don't necessarily think that's always, you know, the case. And I think it's slowly changing, but it's a very slow burn. I think it's a generational thing largely, that, you know, people more of our age and younger are just, you know, coming through and going, I just want to work with good people and do good stuff. Like, I don't care about all this nonsense. Is it going to be stressful at times? Sure. Is it going to be tough? Are things going to go wrong? Yeah, like with any project of any scale, you can't avoid that. It's more, how are we going to handle it as a collective when it happens, as opposed to finding someone to point the finger at and blame them and hang them in public. And that feels more like our generation and younger that are aligned with that. And I'm sure you still get a few of the you know, past generations that, you know, like to do it differently, but life's too short, I think, to do anything other than support each other.
Oh man, give me somebody that I can share a beer with over somebody that just has talent, like 11 times out of 10.
That's such a, yeah, super interesting. I was asked to be on a show yesterday talking about some of the casting people I've had on, and they asked me, what's one of the main things you've learned? I said, well, I've not really learned anything new per se from them. They've just reaffirmed stuff I kind of knew, which was great. But the main through line a lot of the time was, yeah, you have to be talented. Like, you have to have some degree of skill in what you're doing and hone that craft. But your personality and your character is equally, if not more important. Like, your talent might get you one job, but if you're not a good person, or you're just tough to work with, or you're a complete asshole to people, that's it. You're only going to get the one job. Like, you're not going to come back. And, you know, what you're like as a human being, I think, stands longer stead than what your movie or game or whatever actually did box office wise.
You know, it's interesting because, so I agree with that wholeheartedly. There was a book that I read when I was younger, when I was still super into theater, called An Actor Behaves.
Yes.
And it was a book, I think, that I learned a lot about, and it kind of really professed that particular idea that, you know, it doesn't matter how talented you are, if you're a jerk, nobody wants to work with you. But yet you do still hear some whispers in the industry that, you know, if you can sell tickets, right, if you can put butts in seats, then you can be a jerk, right? And I think there's still some elements of that where it's like some people squeak through. And what are your thoughts on that?
It's money, man. It's what you said, right? That's all it is. It's all it boils down to. It's people will turn the blind eye even though they know it's messed up, because such and such can get attention, and attention is currency, and then that means dollars. And they're like, well, but if we got to turn a profit, as long as the studios are running as businesses, which they are, and profit's the main game, then that's always going to be something that can happen, and it'll slip through the nets. But I think generally en masse, you still want to be dealing with good people as much as you can, and try and avoid that, and treat it as an anomaly. But I'm with you. It's weird that that still can happen. Money talks. Money talks. What can we say? All right, dude. I like to wrap these up. I'm mindful of your time. I know you got a lot to do. You got your family there too. But I like to wrap these up with Inside the Actor's Studio questions. Did you ever watch that
Sure.
show?
Yeah, long
Yeah,
ago, but I haven't
yeah.
watched. Yeah.
So he used to ask 10 questions at the end of the show, if you remember.
I
So
do.
I kind of I've kind of as an homage and total theft, as all artists do, I've stolen them. And branded them as my own. So just quick fire, like whatever comes to mind. The first question is, what is your favorite word?
My favorite word, the word that kind of actually popped into my head is burbuja, in
Like
Spanish.
what's behind you, kind of a little bit with your background there.
It's just a fun word to say, burbuja. Like it's fun.
What's your least favorite word?
Least favorite word, man. I got to tell you right now, it's Trump. That word sucks.
That'd do it. That'd do it. I'm sure there's a lot of people that'll agree with that. What turns you on in a creative, spiritual, intellectual kind of a way?
In terms of inspiration, I'll go back to the Game Developers Conference, and in particular, the Game Developers Conference has these sessions at the beginning of the week, called like these workshops, and there's one in particular called the Level Design Workshop. And it's an area that is so fascinating to me because it actually borrows a lot of techniques from film, from photography, from architecture. And so I learn about, some of these techniques from photography and film and architecture and other areas that, that I didn't study these things. And so that's my time to kind of get inspired. And when I'm playing games, I can spot those techniques being used.
Amazing.
I can be like, oh crap, that's I just went through this thing over here. Like I just learned about that like last week at this level design workshop. Like those are amazing, and that's fuel to my spirit.
You feel like as you kind of expose more to that, and sort of as you get older and have more experience, you can start to see sort of the tapestry of like this thing from what seemed to be way over there actually is linked to this in a way that you never saw before? And
Absolutely.
yeah,
Yeah, I
right.
mean, like I can almost, to this point, I've seen so many of these workshops, and I understand the terminology to such a degree that I can almost hear the conversations that went into place. That, like, okay, they put this here because, right? It's like, I know that in playtesting sessions, there was a playtester that did this thing, and they needed to stop them from trying, right? And so they did this. Like, that's why this thing is here. I can see the connections of. Oh, okay. They probably experienced this thing over here, so that's why they had to put, something like that. So it's absolutely changed the way that I consume games.
In a good way or a bad way? Like, do you find yourself
A
not
bit of
enjoying it
both,
as
right?
much?
It's a bit of both, right? Like,
Yeah.
because a lot of the times, I'll pay $60 for a game, and an hour into it, I'm like, okay, I've already seen everything. I can already extrapolate through the end of the experience. And like maybe there's a couple of twists, but I pretty much got it. I got it. Like 1 to 2 hours, and I got it.
Yeah,
So it's
okay.
like, great. I spend $60 for an hour or two of entertainment. But then occasionally a game comes out that, like, even if I do spot some of these things, it's just such a special game that I can't put it down. And like, Naughty Dog games are like that for me. So like The Last of Us, Last of Us Part Two, like I couldn't put those games down, even though I could recognize a lot of the techniques that were being applied.
It's same as kind of like with movies when you can kind of see what they've done, but there's certain ones that you're like, I know what they're doing, but I'm enjoying seeing how they're doing it, and that's a different kind of ride, but it's still got something about it. a flip to that question is, what turns you off? Is it Trump again? Yeah. A little bit.
I mean, it's certainly dominating my headspace for the time being.
Yeah.
But, you know, what turns me off? Let's say anti-intellectualism. An entire movement that is unfortunately global at this point, of anti-science, anti-intellectualism, it's so difficult to remain civil in the face of it.
Yeah, it almost feels like that's sort of being done intentionally as well, to keep people even more and more divided and separated. And, you know, go flat earthers, anyone out there who's a flat earther, you know, keep on trucking, peeps. Next question, which is probably a really good one after this, is what's your favorite swear word? And it can be in either language.
My favorite swear word. I mean, it's not, it's probably not sexy. It's pretty low hanging fruit, but fuck is the one that I certainly use the most. But if you want me to
jazz it up a little,
if you want me to jazz it up a little, I can always go back to gilipollas, which is just such a good word. It's a really good word.
There's something about swearing in Spanish that has a different thing about it, though. Like it feels just much more fluid, and it's so much more ingrained and just a more acceptable part of the culture. So it's just like, you know, and like, if you translate it to English, people look at you and go, "You can't say that." It's like, no, they say it all the time. They say it to their mom, like "me cago en la puta." It's like, you can't say that, but it's like in Spanish, it's like saying good morning.
Yeah,
gilipollas is a good one, but fuck is a standard one that I think is just low hanging fruit, but it's like a Batman utility belt. It's perfect for all causes.
It's so flexible.
Yeah. Next question is, what's your favorite sound or noise?
My favorite which noise?
Sound
or noise. Sound my or favorite noise. Sound or noise. So the first thing that popped into my head is being in Orlando City Stadium when we score a goal. Just that eruption of noise is addictive. That explosion of energy, explosion of noise like that. That is, it's a special thing. It's a special, like, I'm sure you
can't put words to it. Yeah. That's the thing. It's hard to, I mean, I even find when you step into a stadium, like when you step into the Bernabeu, or even when I go here and, you know, in Leeds, go to the stadium here, there's something about you kind of step over and you kind of see the first bit of green of grass. And then you kind of hear the chants, and they have the music playing, and there's something about it that you can't put into words that stirs something up. For me, I think with the teams as well, because I relate to them from having roots in either Leeds or Madrid, there's something beyond just the sport. I don't know if it's the same with you with Orlando, that you feel like it's more than just...
No, it is to it. Like, you know, I don't think that I would feel it if I went to, you know, another city in the United States and like watched one of their soccer teams play, it's like, it wouldn't feel the same, right? There's a connection that I feel to Orlando because I was here and I was already going to Orlando games before they went to MLS.
Right.
And so seeing them go into MLS and being there for that first match when there were 65,000 people in the stadium, and we were all on the edge of our seats just waiting for something to lose our minds about. And then Kaká scores a goal at the very end of the game to tie it up 1-1, and the stadium went ballistic. And then the next year we did even better. We were losing 2-0 when we get into stoppage time at the end of the game, and we scored two goals in 2 minutes in stoppage time to tie it up at the very end of the game, again in front of 65,000 people. It's like, you can't describe that experience. It's, you know, there's an attachment there because I watched it go from lower levels to MLS. And, you know, I've been in Orlando now for a while. And so, you know, there's a connection there. And, you know, it's similar to that connection that I feel to Real Madrid or, You know, that's really the only other one that I feel that kind of connection to. When it comes to the Premier League, I follow players more than I follow teams. So it's the two teams that I think I still have an emotional connection to is Orlando City and Real Madrid.
Which makes sense completely because of just, your life's journey. And I think, yeah, hopefully fans can get back into the stadiums. I don't think it's this year. I think it's next year at best.
We
But
do have limited capacity at Orlando City Stadium at the moment,
right.
which I think is bonkers dumb, but it's that's how it is.
What are they on? Like 30% or 10% or 20
Yeah, it's
or.
somewhere, I think, so it's a 25,000, the new stadium that we're in is a 25,000 seater, and I think that they're allowing somewhere in the vicinity of 5,000 fans in there.
They were doing tests here in the UK and then they've decided to stop it for the rest of the year. They only just started and it was like 1 or 2,000 people in like 30,000 seater stadiums. And now they're like, just no, next year. And that's here where it's not, I mean, it's spiking a little again, but it's not quite as bad as there, but each to their own. What's your least favorite sound or noise?
Least favorite sound or noise? I don't know that I have something that fits into this category.
Okay. Should we say the sound of rival fans celebrating a goal against Orlando?
No, because I can usually, it's not that com because of the structure of the United States, it's not that common to hear the rival fans.
Fair enough.
Like not that many are going to take a flight cross country, right? Not many Vancouver fans coming to Orlando for,
Lack of dedication. God damn it. It's a different
but I
thing
guess
too. It's a different thing. I get it.
For the time being, my least favorite sound is a bonkers obnoxious children's toy.
Okay.
I'll
Okay.
just go with that. Like if
Okay.
there's a children's toy like that my daughter has that is inordinately loud and like there's no sound setting on it, there's no ability to like turn it down. It's just it's intrusively, aggressively loud. That's my least favorite sound. It's like I don't mind hearing the toys and the sounds and all that stuff, but there's a certain like decibel where it's just like, is that necessary? Like, what are you trying to do to my child's ears with this thing? Like, you can't even entertain any other
Thought.
thoughts when that kind of like aggressive sound is
They've
in
done it
play.
on purpose just to get to the parents, I think. They've done it on purpose. What, they're clearly parents themselves, and they're like, you know what? If I'm gonna suffer, I'm gonna make everybody else go down with me. Final few questions. What job or profession other than your own would you most like to attempt?
This one should be pretty easy. I still have a lot of fondness for acting, so it's something that's always been in the back of my mind, and even occasionally, I even entertain like, did I make a mistake, by switching gears? But ultimately, I have no regrets. I'm happy with the journey that I've taken. But if I ever needed to completely leave what I'm doing now and go in a different direction,
Who knows?
acting, I miss it.
Oh man, you put it out there now. Next time I make like a short film or something of my own, I'm gonna bring you in for a small part just to dangle a carrot. I'll be like, come on, man.
Put me in, coach.
Well, you've said it now. What job or profession would you never want to attempt under any circumstances?
So I the first thing that popped in my head is probably garbage so
Yeah.
it's a job that is physically very demanding, a job that is underappreciated, but a job that I understand compensates actually fairly well, for what they do and the strain that they put on their bodies and stuff like that. It's not a job that would be appealing to me. Like it's
That's fair. I think that's totally fair. Okay, final question is, when it's all said and done, What would you like the story of your life to be? What kind of legacy, for lack of a better term, would you like to leave behind?
So I think that that's I think that changes when, at least it did for me when I had a kid. When I think before I had a kid, I really just wanted to make an indie game. Like it's something that I've kind of always kind of gone back to and be like, man, I want to make something that's mine, that's my own. But the amount of hours it takes to do something completely on your own, it's a monster endeavor. Even for things that are fairly scoped down, it can still be a monster endeavor. And it's something that I always kind of gravitated towards. If somebody asked me something along these lines, it's like, I want to make my own game. I want to express myself. I want to put something out there, and have it be respected. Not necessarily like successful or anything along those lines, but just hearing even one person in the industry be like, oh yeah, I played that, and like that was actually pretty cool. Like that would be enough for me if only one person played it and they were like, yeah, that was cool. But when we had our daughter, I think it just changed. Like I want her to be better than me. So I guess all I really want is for her to look back and feel that I worked hard to instill proper values in her, and that I supported and loved her appropriately, and that I was a meaningful part of her life, and that my involvement made her a better person and made her better than me.
That's awesome, man. I love that. Where, if people want to find out more about you or connect with you, where can they find you if you're on the socials or anything like that? And
You can't find me, buddy. I'm a hermit.
woo, awesome. Okay, well then, aside from that, do you have like any kind of closing little remarks, anything you want to button this chat off with in terms of people that are interested in games or maybe want to get into games, like sort of a nice way to button this chat off?
Sure. So one of the things that we started off by talking about was, what do we say to people who are interested in getting into games? And so I guess my final piece of advice is this. Playing games is not this is does not necessarily mean that you are going to be open to creating games, right? So much to the same degree, and I'm sure you've probably heard this analogy before, but enjoying food does not mean that you're going to become an all-star chef.
Makes so much more sense now.
There is a difference between consuming and developing, and people really underestimate how much of a special freak you need to be to want to do this for a living. And I imagine that is 100% true for film as well. Like you just need to have. You need to be a special kind of nerd, and almost just like maniacally driven to want to do this for a living. And so there's billions of game players in the world. There's only thousands and thousands of game makers. And so if everybody that enjoyed consuming games could go into making games, they probably would have, right? Like it's just understand and respect the difference between the two, research and understand what you're getting into if that's what you want to do. And then work harder than anybody else. And good luck.
Awesome, awesome parting words. All right, that was today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the chat with my longtime friend Fernando de la Cruz. Really intriguing to hear about some of the parallels that do exist between the video game world and the film and TV world, especially about the way the narrative is deployed in both and really how you need to have that key understanding of what story is. If you like this episode, you can check out the video version of it over on YouTube. And please do help spread the word, share the podcast, let people know about it. It'll be rare to have too many game-related guests like Fernando. This is probably an anomaly, so regular service of film and TV guests will likely resume imminently. And as always, thank you for tuning in and taking the time to listen to me rattle on and talk to people.